the Eternity Podcast Network, eternitypodcasts.com.au.
Hello, I'm Jenny Salt, and welcome to Salt, a place where we'll enter into the lives of people and discover heartwarming, sometimes challenging, yet always distinctive gospel stories.
I sort of approached that sort of naively. I looked at missionaries later or students here who were looking at mission, and they just seemed so informed, and they were asking all these really intelligent questions, and I'm thinking I didn't ask any of those.
My guest today is Sharon Hall. Sharon grew up with an open-air preacher for a dad and a piano accordion playing mum. And God was always a big part of her childhood. She dreamt of going to Africa as a missionary teacher. But God had other plans and took her to Green Hills on the other side of the world. Welcome, Sharon.
Thanks, Jenny. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's lovely having you here. You've travelled from where today? Because we're sitting in Croydon in Sydney at the moment. Where have you travelled from?
Travelled from Razorback, which is between Camden and Picton. A lot of people remember it as the road that you used to climb up the old Hume Highway and see cars on the side of the road with radiators steaming, and now we just all zoom up there and it's easy. Okay. So we can see the city from where we live. Okay. So it's a lovely view.
Oh, that's lovely. And where did you grow up?
Grew up mostly in the Blue Mountains, so from when I was six, and again, there was a nice view there. So, yes, grew up there until the time when I really came to Bible college. Mm. So, yeah.
And what was childhood like for you, Sharon? What were you like as a child?
Well, I probably was a little bit bossy. I loved to play school, so I made my brother be a student. He tried once to be a teacher. I said, okay, I'll be the student, but then he couldn't think of what to do, so we swapped again. But yes, I always enjoyed doing that. So I was a pretty not terribly adventurous, but also as I grew into a teenager, had a lot of friends around at our place, I think because we had a pool.
Yeah, that'll do it every time. Did you grow up in a Christian home?
Yes. So even from before I was born, Mum tells me that my dad was with Open Air Campaigners, and he used to do some evangelism when it was legal in the streets in Martin Place.
It's not legal anymore?
I don't think it is, or you've certainly got to get a permit.
Okay.
And that was in the days when people would gather around to listen, whereas now I think they just walk past. But yes. Mum was playing the piano accordion when that was legal or acceptable.
I don't think that's acceptable.
No. She got me to sell it recently, which I was delighted to do. But apparently she was pregnant with me while she was playing the piano accordion while my dad was sharing the gospel.
So your dad was preaching, your mum was playing the piano accordion, and you were in utero.
Yes, I was just growing away there. So,
And did your dad continue to be an open-air evangelist?
Yes, he did for a little while. And on my birth certificate, it says that my father's occupation is an evangelist. So that's a great
legacy. And your mum a piano accordion player?
So she... He went on to be a minister in a couple of Baptist churches, and then eventually ended up driving Greyhound coaches. So he did that for years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So growing up in a Christian home with an evangelist or a Baptist teacher dad, and your mum was a Christian as well, it's not surprising that you became a Christian, or at least, you know, you were exposed to that. But how did you become a Christian? How old were you when you became
a Christian?
Yeah,
I think I was about 5 or 6. So it was just before we moved to the Blue Mountains, and it must have been a Sunday school teacher that told us about asking Jesus into our life. And very young age, I understood that meant I could go to be in heaven with him. That sounded great. So I probably didn't understand an awful lot, but I remember I must have been challenged because I made that decision to do that. I told my mum, I went into the house and said, I've just asked Jesus into my heart. She said, that's good, dear. So there weren't major changes in my life, but at that point, but obviously grew into that faith and yeah.
Mm. And you were part of the local church.
Yes, very
and
much
what
so.
Are some of your memories of being part of a church family?
Well, that very early time was a church in Narrabeen, and so literally there were surfies coming to church and leaving their surfboards at the door.
That's a rather lovely picture, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, and I remember, you know, like any good Baptist church, I always remember the baptisms, yes. The water baptisms, and just feeling quite moved by them. I didn't obviously understand everything that was going on, but I knew it was significant.
Was it at the beach in Narrabeen?
No, it was just in a pool in the church.
Okay. That's a pity.
Yeah, it would have been great. I don't think we actually – we went to the beach once as children, even though it was just down the road, because mum didn't like the beach. So I think we went once when my auntie visited.
And what about when you were living in the mountains, the Blue Mountains? What was church life like there?
Yeah, I think we had in my teenage years, my parents started going to a Pentecostal church, a fairly large one. So that was an interesting sort of difference, I guess. Mm. But there was always a centre of the Bible, and I always, from my parents, even grandparents, just had a hunger to want to learn the Bible. And I remember even at that stage thinking, and they'd been to Bible college before I was born, and I thought that would be a good thing to do. So, yeah.
Mm. Now, judging from your playing with your brother and in schools, were you thinking about doing teaching, and is that what you did after school?
Yeah, I was naively thinking, because we had a lot of missionary friends when I was little. Mum and Dad knew them from college days, and so I thought I would be a missionary, but naively thought that I would go and teach English and probably European history to students in Africa. I think that's somehow how I put everything together. So no, I didn't end up being a teacher. At the end of my arts degree at Sydney, I thought, well, I could go to Bible college now, or I could do the what was then just a one-year diploma of education. Mm. So I'll go to Bible college first and then do the teaching bit, but I never did get to the teaching bit.
So. And what about the African bit? Is that still kind of feature when you went to Bible college? Well, I imagine that Africa would be on the agenda for...
Yes, well, that was kind of all I knew. And I came here, actually, where we're sitting, to Sydney Missionary and Bible College, and went to the Africa prayer group because that's what I knew of, and then heard about the Europe prayer group. And I thought, well, that's just really funny. People only go there for holidays. So I'll just go because it's interesting. And right from the first visit, just thought, oh, my goodness. I think I was just shocked by how little gospel witness was there in most of the countries of Western Europe anyway. Mm. So I kept going.
And in keeping going, what were you thinking and where were you thinking you would go? So being a missionary was the plan, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And where was up for grabs? But now that you're going to the Europe prayer group,
yeah.
Europe was now in your sights.
Pretty much every week, whatever country we were praying for, I thought, oh, I need to go there. Yes. At one point I was going to go to Luxembourg. knew nothing about it. We had a family who he then later was my boss, but they were ready to go to the Ukraine, the Bussatul family. And so I thought I could go there. Knowing nothing about it, but knowing they were lovely people, thought I could go and work with them. Mm. But then one day one of the students presented on Ireland, on the Republic of Ireland, and I just was struck by it. I had no prior interest in Ireland. It wasn't like I loved Riverdance or anything like that. it just was struck. And I remember him saying, not many missionaries go. The ones that do come home, and it's a hard and slow place. And you would think that would turn you off, but I at that time was doing some just part-time chaplaincy work to pay my school fees at the Presbyterian Retirement Village, and was working with a lot of older folk who thought they were Christians because they'd been to Sunday school and they were good people. And I thought, that's slow and hard, trying to explain the gospel to them and having them say, that's lovely, dear, but I hope I'm good enough. So I thought, well, maybe I could do that kind of work. And so I wouldn't have known it at the time, but I guess that was God's way of just getting my attention for something I'd never thought about. So,
yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, that when someone says it's slow and hard ministry, that would be a real turnoff for some people, you know, thinking I want to do something strategic and big and it's going to have a huge impact. Slow and hard isn't really going to sell it, but it sold it for you.
I think partly because I was experiencing that at the time, and I'm not naturally an adventurous person and probably not naturally strategic either, but I had never travelled overseas. I wasn't really good at meeting people for the first time. I was a bit of a scaredy cat. So I think knowing something that I maybe had a little bit of familiarity with was partly what got my attention, but yeah.
Thinking about cross-cultural mission? We'd love to chat with you about how our mission expertise and training can prepare you well to use your skills to cross all kinds of cultural barriers. The SMBC Missions faculty consists of 3 full-time missiologists who have an extensive range of cross-cultural experiences. However, it's not just the missions lecturers that enhance missions experience at SMBC. Many of the other lecturers and staff have also served across the world in cross-cultural ministry. At SMBC, a conviction and passion for mission is woven into every aspect of the college's curriculum. To see just how unique SMBC's training in mission is, head to smbc.edu.au/about and look for the Centre for Missions at SMBC. So you did end up going to Ireland, to the Republic of Ireland. And what was that like? How long were you there for, Sharon? And what sort of ministry did you do?
I was there for 17 years in the end with a few home assignments. It was slow and hard, and still is for the people that are still working there. On average, I would say it takes about 4 years for an Irish person to trust you and be your friend, to be a genuine friend. But once they're your friend, they're friends for life. They're very loyal people. But, yeah, it was difficult. I started out, I was placed in a rural town in Tipperary, literally in the middle of the country, some would say in the middle of nowhere. And that was a tough gig. I didn't know it at the time. I probably wouldn't have gone if I did, but that was probably the centre of traditional Catholicism, and there was a lot of, at that time, a lot of angst and anger against those who were born-again Christians. So there was first-generation believers in that church who'd come to faith in their adult life. So that was just really being part of a small church of first-generation believers, no grandparents of the faith, so to speak. So a lot of it was just helping model what it is to be a Christian, and maybe someone who's been in a Christian family was handy. And then over the years moved to Nina nearby to help with a church plant there. Not that I was a church planter at all, but, just kept turning up. And then down to Waterford, where the crystal used to be made, to be part of a small church plant there. And then I finished up my time in Dublin in kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. So that was in an established, larger church by Irish standards, and working with women there. So it was sort of a broad spectrum of things. So, yeah.
Sharon, when you were in Tipperary or Waterford, were there times when you realised just how different people related to you, or how different it was to be Catholic in Ireland? How did you see that play out in people?
I mean, I'm obviously talking about Ireland a while back. It is different now, but in certainly in Tipperary at that time, we would deliver calendars sometimes, and you would have most people would just accept it politely because that was the thing they did, but then others would chase me down the road and tear it up in front of me. So, you know, there wasn't always pleasant things. But I think the thing that really made me realise was when I was in Waterford and I joined a Scrabble club in the library as a way of getting to know people. And, you know, they accepted me and they thought I was a little unusual, but, you know, they knew I was that kind of Christian. And it wasn't until an Irish Christian with a Catholic Irish name from a Catholic background who was in our local church, Teresa, she came to Scrabble Club. And a few weeks in, they found out that she came to the church that I was at. And that's where they all stopped and said, no, you can't be at that church because you're Irish. And that's when I realised that for me as an Australian to be an evangelical Christian or born again, as they would say, you're one of those born agains, that was not a problem for them because I was a foreigner. But when they heard that not only this Teresa, who was Irish but also Catholic by identity, you know, in terms of her background, that's where, and then they started to ask lots of questions, and that meant I could also be there to help in answering some of those too. But it was, that showed me how much it wasn't really about the religion itself, it was about a national identity. And now that's changed, there is a shift in that since I've been there, but that was very much the case then.
You describe ministry as being hard and slow and not particularly strategic, but were there moments and times when you saw what the Lord was doing through you or through the ministry of the gospel while you were there?
Yes. I mean, I would say that most things seemed to happen when I left a town. The bypass would get finished, the roads, and then suddenly things would happen in the churches. Now, people would try and reassure me that, that, you know, I'd done the groundwork on it. No, I don't think so. But even the one story that stands out to me is the story of Judith, who I was asked to go and see her mum in a town, Nina, where there was no evangelical church at the time. She wanted to read the Bible with someone. It turned out she just basically wanted someone to have a cup of tea and a chat. But in that, met her daughter for 2 minutes because they were going to travel out to Australia. And I said, without asking my parents, oh, you could stay with my parents. And so they did for 2 weeks. But during that time, it turned out that Judith, before that, had been praying. She'd sit in Mass and she'd hear the homily and she'd hear the Bible reading and she'd think, I want someone to explain this. I know there's more. And then the homily would happen and it wouldn't help, and should I want more? And she came out, stayed with my parents and my cousin at the time, who is a very gifted evangelist, and she came to faith. And my mum said at the end of the stay, oh, Judith has become a Christian. I said, Mum, I don't think so, but we'll just wait and see. Me of little faith. And I started meeting with her to go through Christianity Explored. I'd go up to the town because she was living in a town where there are absolutely no other believers that we knew of in the whole town. And I'd meet with her, and then one day I had the courage to finally ask her, so, you know, where do you think you stand with this sort of grace thing and accepting Jesus' salvation, you know? She said, well, I think I am a Christian. I've become a Christian. I said, oh, now what do you think you mean by that? And so, you know, I was very gifted at this. And she went on to explain that salvation, and she just grew and grew in her faith and then went to Bible college and now an active, you know, member of her local church. And so that's a story that almost despite myself, God worked certainly through my family. But I think my experience was more being able to sit beside and watch, yes, God doing stuff in, yes, people's lives. So, yeah.
It's curious that you describe yourself as someone who's a bit of a scaredy cat and not particularly adventurous, because that's huge, moving to another country as a single woman and being in the middle of nowhere, as some people might describe it, and going to new churches and church plants. Why do you think you kept doing that, where perhaps others didn't and found it too hard. Because 17 years is a pretty long stint.
And I went when I was 25 and I honestly don't know. It had to be God because it wasn't again, I sort of approached that sort of naively. I looked at missionaries later or students here who were looking at mission and they just seemed so informed and they were asking all these really intelligent questions. And I'm thinking, I didn't ask any of those. You know, I felt like I ended up where I should be and where God wanted me to be. But, yeah, I sometimes feel like he almost suspended my own judgment and somehow got me there. Looking back, I see, yes, oh my goodness, if I'd have tried to go and learn a language in the Ukraine, just wouldn't have been good for me. So God knew all of that. Mm. I think my mum would say, interestingly, but she didn't tell me this till after I got there, she wrote in a beautiful letter, she would say that before I was born, she had a sense that she would have to say goodbye to me in that I would go off to serve God somewhere. Mm. So it was no surprise to her when I did that. It was sad. I mean, they were happy that I was doing it, but obviously there was grief. So I think it always came down when I was questioning what on earth was I doing going over the other side of the world. I hadn't even seen the place. I just packed my bags and went. I'd seen a photo of the pastor and his wife that I was going to work with and I thought they looked nice. that was it. But I think it always came down to the fact that here in Sydney particularly, if someone wanted to hear about Jesus or learn about him, they could go to just about any choice of places within a 5 kilometre radius and hear something. And hear the Bible taught. In Ireland, there was still, certainly where I was ministering in the Midlands, people would have to travel sometimes an hour to get to the nearest evangelical church, not one that they loved the music at that or had a good youth program, just the only one. And so knowing that that was the case, I think that always drove me when the decisions were difficult. Yeah. Mm.
So obviously there were challenges in living and serving in Ireland. What about as a single woman? What was that like?
I think I didn't go wanting to be a single woman. The opportunity hadn't come up before that, so I just went. And being in a country where people just aren't naturally physically affectionate, it took me a few years, but I got to a point where I thought, I feel like I should just run out into the street and ask some random person if they just give me a hug. And I'm not normally a huggy person. And I shared that with a woman at church and said, I'm really struggling. I don't have my family around me to just give me a normal hug. And she just must have... such a huge thing for her in her culture. She just from then on, whenever she saw me, would give me a hug. I just thought, although that would be a big thing for her to do that. I think it got a little bit easier in that sense as I moved different places. But it was a challenge. And I don't think it was till the later years that I started to really feel that. It wasn't so much the desire to be married. I think it was also being away from family and just that almost mundane connection you have with family. You know, you have all your little argy-bargies and whatever, but you can sit with them and just be sort of switched off. And so whenever you with, I often think if I'd have got a pet dog, that might have helped. Just someone that, you know, to come home to that's different to your work. Would have helped. And later it was a minister in England said that very thing. He said, I often feel for single people in ministry that there's just not that almost like distraction of family, albeit that brings with it issues and tiredness, but you know, something different from what you're doing. So
in some cultures it's very unusual to be single and perhaps even viewed with suspicion. What's the Irish culture like when it comes to marriage and singleness?
I think at one stage Well, I realised later that most people thought I was a nun and, you know, that was a category for them and kind of functionally I was, you know, I was someone who had decided to follow Jesus and be devoted to serving him. Yes. And so in some ways that may have been an easier way to introduce myself as a evangelical nun.
As a category they understand.
Yes. As I got older, I think it got harder because as you get older as a single woman, you're sometimes maybe a little bit more suspicious to couples, particularly to wives. Whereas I heard someone say single men get embraced by families and couples, you know, and sort of taken in. So I think as the years went on, that did get harder. But it wasn't a culture where I think a woman, a single woman in ministry wasn't a foreign thing to them. Right. They had a little bit of a category for that. So.
Yeah. I want to tell you about another podcast, which is a great listen. It's called Evangelism in a Skeptical World with Sam Chan. Now, if you know anything about Sam, he is a great evangelist. He's very well thought through and has some great advice on what it means to talk about the gospel in a modern context. To find out more about this and other great podcasts, go to eternitypodcasts.com. So you spent 17 years, including home leave, in Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, and then you came home. Why did you come home? Well, why did you come back, I should say?
Yes, yeah. I came back to work here for a year, actually, to help students thinking about maybe exploring mission work for themselves. But before I came back for that, I had a sense deep inside that I just didn't think I could do it anymore. But I didn't want to say that because I thought I don't want to then find that God challenges me to, yes, you can, you know, get back there and then have to. So I just kept that to myself. But actually, I packed up everything because I needed to vacate the home, and I separated it into, no one knew that, but into blue boxes and red boxes so that if I decided to stay here, so I guess I had that in my mind that I probably was going to have to have an out. But that's a hard thing to do and to say and to give reasons for, I think, the longer you've been there. So,
And why were you, do you think, preparing boxes just in case you didn't go back?
I wouldn't have known it at the time. It's now a bit of a buzzword and people know about it, but later on understood that I would have been experiencing burnout and probably the beginnings of depression for a time that I went through. It was a series of things. I honestly think it was partly just the build-up of years and years of ministry, albeit good, and you know, I loved living in Ireland. It was a beautiful place to live and the people, but I think that was just taking its toll. And then being so, combination of personal things that happened around the same time, losing one of the best ministers I'd ever worked for and have known ever since he moved on to a different church, and then just being in a large church with pastoral responsibility for so many women, and as you got to know them better, they shared more and more of the struggles in their life. And hearing that as someone, and not, it was then that I thought, if I could just pay someone for an hour a month to hear these confidential things and bounce back. I didn't have that at the time, but so pretty much that's why I came back. I thought I came back for the job, but also thought I think this might be the end of my time.
It's so interesting, Sharon, that you say that, because that's what you're doing now, isn't it?
Yes.
You are someone who is a pastoral supervisor and women and men who are in ministry speak to you and just use you as a sounding board, among other things, for the sort of experiences and ministry challenges that they're facing.
Yeah. because at the time I didn't know it was a thing. And I thought, if we could just, I need to buy someone's time so that I don't have to care what they're going through in their life. I just want them to listen to what, you know, I'm doing in my work. And I wanted it to be focused on my ministry practice. And I wanted to have a positive way out, if possible, like a way forward in whatever I was facing. And I got back, and through talking with a counsellor actually and working through all the depression and burnout, and she said, what would you do if you went back or didn't go? I said, well, I don't want to be a church planter. I'm pretty hopeless at that, and I can't work in parish ministry again. I'm just, I've done my bit. And but I said, I think I'd like to just, I don't know, either offer somewhere for people to come and stay who need a rest in ministry, or just a listening ear and help support them. She said, well, that sounds very like supervision, and I think you'd be good at that. And so I looked into it and thought, oh my goodness, that's what I had articulated in my head anyway of what I needed. And so I did the training and thought, yes, This is a home for me. I love this.
So, that's wonderful. And you would bring so much to that space because of your experience and a certain empathy there, that in understanding what others are experiencing. That's wonderful, Sharon. And you also, since being back, you've been back 7 years. You are married.
Yes.
To Nick.
Yes.
And tell us what you and Nick are doing, as well as doing your pastoral supervision. You and Nick are involved in another area of life and service.
Yeah. So when, before we got married, we had the conversation I guess all people should have before they get married. Would we think of having children? And I was in my mid-40s and I thought that's probably not sensible. And Nick was 10 years older and he'd raised three now adult daughters. And so we thought that's probably not something we need to do, but we always thought somehow we would try and help with children somehow, even if it was just babysitting for people. And it was actually during the first lockdown and the COVID thing where we just were alerted to something I'd nearly forgotten about the world of fostering. And so we looked into that. We applied through Anglicare. We did the long interview process. It's reassuringly thorough. And I thought at the end of this, if they think we're suitable for this, then, you know, with knowing all our foibles and failings. And so we were approved and I'm really hoping, so Nick and I tag team very much so with fostering, and I'm really hoping that he has gotten the little baby that we're fostering to her visit on time today as we speak.
Today.
So she's visiting with her parents, which happens twice a week. So our job is short-term fostering, and so we give the parents, essentially the birth parents, an opportunity to do whatever needs to happen in their life to make the changes they need to make if they can. And it's giving them that time while we make sure the baby's safe and loved and cared for. And so, yeah, it's also our job to teach that baby. So we, you know, people say, I couldn't do it, I'd get too attached. And we say, well, that is actually the point. You have to get attached to them and teach them that that's a thing that can happen. Yeah.
Sharon, how do you reflect on the way that your life has gone, given that you married in your 40s, you didn't expect to have children, and here you are, you and Nick, looking after little ones who need your love and support as Christian foster parents or foster carers? How do you reflect on that?
Yes, I mean, in one way, I'm thankful that I didn't ever have a strong desire to have children, because I think that would have been painful, and it is for many in their childbearing years. But it's just been, I didn't go into it because I wanted babies in my life. I thought that's going to be a whole load of lack of sleep, and it is. I think it's surprised both of us. People often say to us, I couldn't do that. And it's not like we can either. We still grieve. I still get choked up when I get a photo of the last little baby that was with us. And yet Nick said the very words he said, I couldn't imagine not having had that little child in our life. And I think, so I just see it as a huge privilege that we get to, and, you know, it is hard work and it's exhausting. And we have the, you know, unlike parents, we have the luxury of having a break in between. saying, okay, we'll have a few months off and get some sleep and housework done. But it's just beautiful. And I think even to sit with them and read that both babies have loved this rhyming Bible that someone passed on to us. So we read the little stories and just to see so many stories that I'd never noticed about little babies and children being away from their family, Moses, Samuel, even Jesus himself. You know, that these amazing stories that you keep reading to them and thinking, you know, that God does amazing things through these little ones. And so we pray with them. We take them to church. They love the singing and we have a pipe organ at church and they flap their arms when it starts playing. So we love the idea that they're growing up with hearing those. Yeah, I get choked up when I sing to the little babies. There's usually I have a song list of about three songs, and this little one came to us 2 days before Christmas, so it's all Christmas carols. So Silent Night still calms her down. but it is a privilege, and but it does hurt when you've got to say goodbye. Yeah, it hurts a lot. So.
And your little one that you have, you're currently fostering, mm-hmm. How old was she when she came to you guys?
She was 2 months. So the first one came to us at 6 days old, straight from hospital. This one came at 2 months old from hospital. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so she's doing, well, they're both doing fabulously well. So the first one, she's gone to be with a lovely Christian family, and they keep in touch and send us videos and photos and have asked us to be godparents, which made us both cry. So she's doing very well in a lovely family. Yeah. And this little one, she's doing great too, and her parents are working very hard. Mm. So,
for someone who describes themselves, as I said before, as a scaredy cat and someone who's not adventurous, you have done a lot. That sounds scary, including fostering little ones. But Sharon, it's just so lovely to hear your story and to hear what the Lord is doing in and through you. Thank you for sharing that with us today.
Thanks, Jean.
I hope you've enjoyed being part of the conversation with Sharon today, and importantly, been encouraged to be salt and light to those around you. In the next episode, I'll be talking to a woman who saw her family shattered, scattered, and lost, but whose journey to fill the void ended with far more than she hoped for. I'll see you then. Salt is hosted by me, Jenny Salt, and produced by Mark Hadley. Editing by Hadley Inc. For all show notes and more episodes, head to snbc.edu.au/salt. Salt is a Sydney Missionary and Bible College podcast and part of the Eternity Podcast Network, an audio collection showcasing the seriously good news of faith today. Thanks for making Salt possible.